On Monday, April 23rd, concerned citizens from across the state will congregate in Albany to demand that Governor Cuomo address climate change and halt the expansion of fossil fuels in New York State. Many activists will risk arrest to draw attention to the issue. WOOC correspondent Dave Pueblo recently covered a trial in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, regarding a similar protest where numerous people lay in a trench to stop construction of a gas pipeline. All defendants were found guilty by reason of necessity. Found not guilty by reason of necessity. Here is an excerpt from the interview with Nathan Phillips, a science professor at Boston University. We begin with a question about whether science brought him into the environmental movement.
I don't think the science brought me into the movement, but I will recap my background. So in a science career, it's kind of like an onion, and the core of the onion is that I'm a tree physiologist. My training is how water moves through soils and into roots and through the stems and out of the leaves, and how carbon is taken up by trees and forests. So I'm an ecologist. By complete serendipity, I learned about gas leaks because gas leaks kill trees. That was the entree. And then, just the mechanism is that the pipeline gas leaks will displace oxygen, and the roots need oxygen to breathe. And if they're cut off from oxygen, they will die, and the tree will die. So that was like the kind of academic, it was the area of expertise I knew, and I was hooked. It's like, why are these trees dying? What's the mechanism? And it quickly became apparent that the loss of trees are a big deal, but also this escaping methane is a big deal because it is a greenhouse gas on steroids. It is many, many times more powerful than CO2. And there are explosions. It was like going through this wormhole into this complete other set of issues that never in my life did I think I would ever be studying. So that's another aspect of science that I think I embrace, is serendipity and circumstance and not being on some linear pathway where you make incremental changes or improvements in a certain field and refine. I mean, that's useful, but it was a very interesting and disruptive change to my own career.
In what way? I mean, just this action or your the knowledge, your awareness of the trees and your that?
Yeah, so the gas leaks were something that no one knew about except for the utilities and the regulators. You didn't know about it. I didn't know about it. And it was a discovery that was there in plain sight, but since it's invisible, no one saw it. So it was a revelation to me to see that, like, oh, if we put these on a map and everyone can see it, then we've raised awareness. And so it was a different kind of science, and it was coincident. I don't think it drove me into my interest in activism, and especially on climate, but it was coincident with it. So I have to ask myself, if I had never learned about the gas leaks problem, would I still be involved in the resistance to the West Roxbury lateral pipeline? I think the answer is yes. I think that I had been moving in that direction, and I was a very late bloomer in college. I wasn't an activist. I was like nose to the grindstone, do my homework. I was a very, very late bloomer in terms of awareness, social awareness, very late to it. But I think it was happening, and it was happening coincident with this finding about the gas leaks.
How has that shaped your sense of your own power and your own sense of agency in the world? Or how has it how has that grown or changed for you?
I feel energized as a result of this process. And what do we have to lose? I mean, we are here on Earth for decades. And is it about accumulating wealth? Is it about what are we here for? And so I actually think that when one has the privilege of job security, for example, like myself, then it's a responsibility to ask those questions and then to try to think about ways in which we can make a difference.
Boston fancies itself an old city in a number of ways, and it on some level it is, and on other levels it isn't. But it has a lot in common with other old American cities in terms of the infrastructure and leaky pipelines. And I guess what I'm wondering is, cities like Philadelphia or Detroit or D.C. or Baltimore, Albany, New York, have you explored trying to measure gas leakage in those areas, pooling with other academics, maybe like Professor Ingrafia at Cornell? And what have you found so far?
Yeah, so you mentioned Tony Ingrafia from Cornell and Bob Haworth together published, they raised the alarm bells in a publication in 2011 about gas leaks from fracking, and that they were much larger than had been estimated, and that
using conservative figures too.
Yeah, and that gas is not necessarily even better than the dirtiest of energy sources, coal. So they really kind of established the modern, the most recent. They brought into question this idea of a bridge fuel and natural gas as clean fuel. What we've done, what my specialty was in Boston, was finding out that there are leaks here and then starting to quantify, map and quantify those leaks in Boston. And then we found that, well, it's greater Boston and it's Massachusetts. And we did a study in Washington, D.C. that found that, if anything, Washington, D.C. is leakier than Boston. Baltimore is a very leaky city. It's a Rhode Island we've been through. So it's a problem of old infrastructure everywhere. So we know that it's widespread, and we know that the carbon emissions from methane, since it is such a powerful greenhouse gas, from all of these leaks amounts to a significant portion of the greenhouse gas emissions inventories regionally and by state. So it's an important, it's a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions.
How is that information being used at this point politically, as in terms of activism, to try and shape policy?
One of our follow-up studies was, to me, I've never seen a graph that told you what to do policy-wise as clearly as I've seen this single graph. And that graph was the amount of greenhouse gas from gas leaks. And what it showed was that there's not, like, of the there's over 3,000 gas leaks in Boston. But it's not like there's an average size of gas leak, and like some are a little higher and some are a little lower, and it's like this bell-shaped curve. It's not like that. Okay. What it is that there's a lot of small gas leaks, and there's like a handful of gas leaks that are these what we call super emitters. So 7% of the gas leaks contribute 50% of the lost gas, 50% of the lost money, 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So if you can find those few, relatively few, and fix those, you have a very cost-effective way of at least stemming the problem of gas leaks. And that finding, that was published in 2016 by Margaret Hendrick, a PhD student at Boston University, that totally flipped my thinking about how we address the problem. Prior to that, in my mind, I was thinking, okay, bell-shaped curve, there's thousands of leaks and they're all kind of like equal, you know, you gotta do them all. And that, like, the money, that's really expensive to think about fixing those. And I had been in this mode of thinking that, like, well, you know, you can bandage the system, but the real solution is to replace the pipes, because that's like a more lasting solution. But the thing that had bothered me when I was saying those words was, in my mind, I'm thinking like, well, you know, but that's like 50, 60, 70 years. You put a new pipe down and replace a pipe? We're just committing ourselves. We're doubling down on this infrastructure. But when this study came out that showed like a few leaks contribute a outsized portion of the gas, then this phrase came into my mind, which is triage and transition. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I went from saying and thinking, and today I say, bandage the system, find and fix the biggest leaks, and transition a managed decline of our gas system so that we go off of gas and we begin to electrify our building sector, which is what every expert policy person knows we need to do. It's what we're doing with electric vehicles and electrifying the transportation sector. The building sector needs to be electrified. The way to do that is a managed decline where we strand the leak, the 100-year-old leaking pipeline on a dead-end street or a cul-de-sac or a rung of the ladder kind of thing. We need to start thinking about like how we, instead of paying $1.9 million a mile to replace that, which is ratepayer funded, think about flipping those to electrification.
Yeah. Over what kind of time span?
So Massachusetts ratepayers are committed right now to $9.6 billion over the next 17 years to replace about a third of the entire pipeline system in the Commonwealth. That's like the big dig times five, and that's the initial price tag. What we're working on is, can we think about, can we enact a policy which would allow willing streets, dead ends, cul-de-sacs, to, instead of having that 100-year-old pipeline being replaced, reallocate that money at $1.9 million a mile to air source heat pumps, possibly ground source heat pumps, electrification of the stoves, induction cooking instead of gas. We've actually, in partnership with Mothers Out Front and the Home Energy Efficiency Team, which is a nonprofit in Cambridge, we found a lot of interest in municipalities about this. So people are really intrigued by the idea.
Nathan, this morning when you were in front of the judge, you talked about how this trial isn't over. I wonder if you could tell us about the closure that is here, what is winning, what is not won, and really bring us back home.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So I'm disappointed that we did not get a opportunity to have our necessity defense in full, because we had spent so much time and effort developing our necessity defense. I don't feel like justice was served. But I made the comment today that we're still on trial. This matter is not closed. And the trial, the jury is our children, my children, the children of West Roxbury, children throughout the globe, and future generations, and my students at Boston University. They're working so hard to push our society to move to the clean energy systems that everyone knows we need to move to. And they push up against people who say that the foreseeable future is the status quo. I see it in their eyes. And that's what drove me to step into the trench, because I can't look at my own kids, I can't look at my students in the eye and tell them that I did everything that I could to change the direction that we're going in. In fact, it's not just the status quo, it's not just business as usual. new fossil fuel infrastructure like the West Roxbury Lateral Pipeline is going backwards. It's doubling down on 19th century infrastructure that's digging a deeper hole for the children of West Roxbury and children everywhere. So I've talked a lot about being a climate scientist, but really it's being a parent and an educator that made me do what I did and is the basis for my necessity defense.
For more information about Monday's climate march, go to CuomoWalkTheTalk.org.